3, 2, 1.
Here we go. Welcome to the No Normal Show, brought to you by BPD, a marketing services firm that delivers the future to healthcare's leading brands. This show is where we leave all things status quo, traditional, old school, and boring in the dust, and instead we celebrate the new, the powerful, the innovative, the bold, all focused around the future of healthcare marketing and communications. I'm your host, Stephanie Rearwell, EVP of Strategy and Innovation, and I'm joined by a returning guest, Victoria Davis, Group Account Director. Hello, Victoria.
Happy to be back. Having some fun with you.
I know we're going to have fun. We always have fun together. Yes. We have a lot of fun topics to cover, so I'm excited about this one. Speaking of our topics to cover, we have a really interesting headline that the whole world is buzzing about, the business world especially is buzzing about, and that is... what's going on with Warner Brothers, Paramount, and Netflix? This battle is kind of crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. We're going to dig into that. And then our main topic today is takeaways from the virtual summit that we've been doing in partnership with eHealthcare Strategy and Trends. So BPD has sponsored eHealthcare Strategy and Trends AI and Healthcare Marketing Week. And Victoria, you were a guest on that on Friday. So I know you have a lot to say.
All of the things to say. It was a great time. Yes.
Can't wait to hear what you learned, what you heard, and what you shared. We are 2 months away from the Joe Public Retreat. So if you haven't registered, go to bbdhealthcare.com or shoot us a note. You can send us an email, and we will sign you up. And also, speaking of AI and Healthcare Marketing Week, you can also check out bbdhealthcare.com to get content from that week, or you can follow in the No Normal newsletter. Rewind, or go to eHealthcare Strategy and Trends. So lots of different ways to access that info. Okay, Victoria, there was a really interesting conversation that happened here among BPDers about a headline that popped out this week that's very relevant to marketing. And that was the announcement that we always wait for with bated breath from Pantone of what is the color of the year. So this next year, 2026, the color of the year is going to be, drum roll, Cloud Dancer, question mark?
Exactly. Question mark is exactly what I was thinking when I saw it.
I'm just going to leave it there. I'm not going to share any more context. Victoria, tell us. Give us the context.
It's interesting. In case you missed it, yes, Cloud Dancer is the color of the year. What does that even mean? How do you describe Cloud Dancer? Well, Pantone said it is a lofty white neutral whose aerated presence acts as a whisper of calm and peace in a noisy world. It reminded me, Stephanie, of like the old school eggshell or e-crew, just a fancy way of saying a version of white. And candidly, I was a little like, come on, Pantone, bring out something bright and cheery. We need it in this crazy world. And then I kept reading, and it said it is meant to symbolize a calming influence in society. And kind of like a blank canvas, a fresh start. And so I immediately kind of changed my response and said, oh, that is beautiful. And a great way, I think, to embrace a restorative sense for 2026. And I like their approach. And I was gung-ho about it. Like I posted in the BPD Slacks. I put it on my LinkedIn. We were talking about it, Stephanie. And then I logged off for the day and went to Instagram and said, oh no, this is not what I thought. People were going off, Stephanie, and basically calling Pantone tone deaf, and that it was microaggressive. There was conversations around it being whitewashed and racist and a lot of things. And as a person of color, I was like, oh no, did I miss an undertone somewhere? I was laughing because I'm just like, this is fascinating that I don't think people read why it was created. So I was reading all this and I was very conflicted. And then I saw their CEO, Alicia, I think her name is Shmakea, was at an event. And Stephanie, she said that when she saw the color, she knew it was going to be controversial and she knew it was going to facilitate conversation. And that was the point of the color selection to begin with. I know that we talked about it and kind of how powerful creative and color could be in this world right now.
Well, that's a journey.
Right?
I'm glad you took us on the journey. It was like a 48-hour journey. It was a roller coaster. It was an interesting situation. And I agree with you. I think that, like, in this world today, people read headlines and they don't read the full thing. No one has time. I'm not blaming anyone. There's just way too much to get through. So I think people read the headline, they looked at the color, and then they were like, here's my take. And I saw a lot of that too. I had a very similar experience to you, which is like my first reaction was like, millennial grayish. Like, I'm a millennial. I love neutrals. Yeah. This is cool. And then I logged off and also saw, and I went, ooh, like, I totally see that, right? I think it was Dr. Marcus Collins' Instagram post that I saw first, and his reaction was, so the 2026 color of the year is white.
Right. Yes.
And that was his whole post. White. And I was like, oh. But to your point, I think, like, from a marketing standpoint, you know, and you and I really kind of chatted about this, which is how important creative rationale is. And so when you talk about the, you know, CEO's rationale and starting a conversation and calmness is what we need as a society, all of a sudden it becomes a really interesting, actually inclusive cultural type of conversation. You just have to click further to get that rationale to understand why the creative decision was made.
And how often, Stephanie, in our own work, do we have our brilliant creative team really drive that home, right? Clients can sometimes look at things in the same subjective lens, right? Like this is how they are perceiving it. This is how they're looking at it. Maybe this is how it may be perceived regionally, depending upon where they are. And so I love that our creative team always comes up and says, this is the rationale behind it. It also is a good reminder that color is not innocuous at all. So, which we see that a lot, right? Like red, yellow, all of these colors, if you say them, right, something's going to trigger in your mind, both good and bad. And I think it's a good reminder of how intentional we have to be as marketers and creators with the colors that we select, especially when we live in a society that is craving to be seen and there are so many different cultures represented. So,
yeah. Color has meaning in it. It signals things and it signals, you know, it makes our brain react in a way. And last thing I'll say in this topic, are you wearing a Cloud Dancer today to create calmness?
I literally thought about that when I was talking. This is my winter white sweater. So sure, it could be Cloud Dancer. Okay. But I mean, I saw it that way. I saw it as like a very fresh canvas, and I'm someone that definitely can see all different sides of things. But I think, again, it was the rationale that made me say, And I just encourage brands that are listening and clients that are listening, like, include rationales in your decisions, right? It's no longer
externally too.
Like, yes. Cracker Barrel.
And to employees.
Learned their lesson.
Right. They did not include rationale.
People, consumers are smart enough to draw their own conclusions, and sometimes that can be louder than what your intent was to begin with. So it's a great way for people to, you know, kind of control their own brand narrative.
Yes. Okay. Good convo. Next topic is equally controversial. So there's all kinds of headlines, and by the time this episode launches, maybe the headlines will have even shifted further. But we've been watching the reality TV show Eating Popcorn that is Netflix, Warner Brothers, and Paramount. So what's happening is there's this ongoing bid happening for Warner Brothers. And, of course, Paramount is in the bid. Netflix has really upped that bid. Paramount has countered. It's a back and forth. And there's all kinds of discussion in our feeds and, you know, in news outlets about what's actually happening here. What's Netflix's strategy? What does this mean for Hollywood? What does this mean for media? What does it mean for content? And it's getting really heated. So, Victoria, do you want to give any more context or do you want to just jump in and give some of your take here?
I'll give some of my take. My first thought when I saw this, and I think we talked about this again, like in our little riffs and raps, is like Blockbuster is probably like, darn it, we missed it. We missed the mark. We should have jumped in on this when we had the chance. But it's fascinating to see Netflix do this. And I think what I didn't realize and just kind of learned as this was all coming out is how much Warner Brothers owns and how many intellectual properties now Netflix will own. And that make me wonder if the legal and regulatory folks will feel like this is a monopoly, right? So if they're owning this much of what we consume in TV and movies and all of that, how many more folks? I mean, Disney owns everything else, basically. So it's just really fascinating to see, like, if it will actually come to be, if it will actually happen. From a marketing lens, I see nothing but opportunity. I see big opportunities for brands of all types to jump in at the chance to leverage digitally what's happening and then theatrically what's going to be happening over the course of the next, you know, rest of our lives until, you know, it goes away. There's so many different chances. These TV shows and movies are becoming cultural moments in our life. And depending upon what they're talking about, there's all kinds of ways hospitals and health systems can jump into the conversation in a really impactful way that doesn't feel like performative, if you will. When we think about like shows like The Pitt, which is, I believe, on Netflix, is it not? Or is that on ABC? Or anything else that may be coming out, how many different ways could hospitals and health systems leverage consumers now going to these platforms to consume these shows, maybe rewatch some shows, activate them within the communities they serve, within the markets that they serve? I think it'll be a really fun time for our friends in paid media once this all does come to life.
Yeah, I think to your point, you know, we all know at our gut that, you know, in our daily experience that Netflix is a cultural icon and has become a cultural icon and has been for a decade plus. But seeing the financial numbers, you know, I think, Victoria, you pulled out that Netflix is worth valued at $450 billion compared to Warner Brothers at $25 billion. And my, how the tables have turned. Yes. I mean, we all have lived through this. This is not new news, but the numbers really crystallize what I think we experience, which is, you know, Hollywood, the glamour of Hollywood. And now it is really the system that Netflix has built. I really enjoyed, came up in my feed, and I'll make sure I shout out the person that posted this. His name is Sebastian Fernandez. He's a marketer at Procter & Gamble, but he had a really interesting analysis of how, you know, Warner Brothers has an older business model, which is all about you want a hit and you're doing everything you can to just create one Hollywood blockbuster hit that generates massive amounts of revenue. And that's going to fund all your other non-hits. Mm-hmm. And then you have Netflix, which is not concerned about a blockbuster hit. They're pumping out massive amounts of content. Yes, quantity that's going to hit people in a more niche way that keeps them addicted to the platform. Yes. And I just thought that was such an interesting analysis of the business model. And it's a great tell of where we are in society today. It's how social media platforms have evolved. It's how AI systems are going to evolve. It's the platform model. And we talk to a lot of our clients at health systems, but healthier organizations too, of your job now in modern business is to build a platform. Yes. That is sticky and that is addictive. Your job is not to create a one-hit wonder. Yeah. It used to be in music. It used to be in movies. It used to be that in Hollywood. You wanted to win an Oscar and then you were set for life. That is not the job anymore. No. And I just think it's a fascinating study in what modern business truly needs to be.
We are literally having those conversations with our clients. And it's good to see some of them taking our advice and creating these platforms that gives them so much more leg room, right? An opportunity to breathe and for the platform to evolve with them. The one-off situations just feel isolated. And then when you're thinking about, like I guess, going a few clicks down, like, how do you measure that, right? Netflix can say they have all these shows. Yes, they're pumping out a lot, but how many of their shows are part of the cultural conversations that are happening? Love is Blind. I never watched that show, but everyone across every platform is talking about it. And is that like that's reality TV? So it's just really interesting, and I think it will change the ways and not only in which we consume media, but how we are purchasing it and how brands are engaging with Hollywood in new ways.
Yeah. Well, we could probably unpack that all day. But let's move to our main topic because we have a lot to get into here. So we have been glued to our screens, our medium-sized screens this week on AI and Healthcare Marketing Week in partnership with eHealthcare Strategy and Trends. And this has been a full week of programming. So day one was Inside the Real World AI Platforms Leading Health Systems. Day two was all about AI and content. Day three, Wednesday, was all about data-driven marketing. Thursday was AI agents and workflows. And then Friday was enterprise design and a closing keynote. And Victoria, you had an amazing session on Friday around enterprise design. So we'll get into that. But before we do, maybe let's start at the top of last week and let's just talk about, you know, kind of session by session. Perhaps before we do that, Victoria, were there any really big aha moments just overall that you had from this week? Like anything that just stood out to you that you thought either maybe it reinforces something that we already know, or maybe it was a new idea.
I think, and we were kind of talking about this week as well, and just our own like prep for these webinars, is that how quickly this conversation has evolved, right? We went from it being maybe not at the top of everyone's to-do list, but like, oh, an idea during, you know, we'll get to it in a second. And now it's at the top of everyone's to-do list. And I think that's great. What I think is interesting is people that are attending the conversations were probably feeling like they were behind. There wasn't a really good sense of where systems were in the life cycle of creating AI programs and agents. And there wasn't a lot of conversation around like, where do we start? And based upon things that I'm seeing, all the speakers across the board were saying, now is the time to engage. Now, like 2026, put it on your list, engage, create your internal champions, your governance, your steering committees, whatever that may be. If you're starting from square one, that's perfectly fine, but you have to start in 2026. Because if you don't, which is what we talked about in my conversation, is by the time you get to the end of next year, this time next year, and you haven't done anything, you will be behind. And it will be far more expensive for you to jump in and try to catch up. And the speed by which these agents and the generative AI is evolving, you may never catch up. I mean, who knows what may happen in a year from now. So I think that was an aha moment. And it was kind of more encouraging and I think reassuring for attendees.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, I mean, first of all, props to eHealthcare Strategy and Trends for putting this on. And getting such an amazing list of speakers, everyone from, you know, Cleveland Clinic to Providence and Baptist Health and, gosh, the list is really long, Hackensack Meridian. but, you know, these are folks that have been out in front for a long time. And by a long time, it's relative. It's
2 years.
2 years, 3 years right, max. But and some of them have a year under their belt. But a year in AI time is like 10 years in normal time. If you're really running at it. And what I think is awesome, I'll just put a finer point on what you said and then we'll dig into the sessions, Victoria. But, you know, you and I were chatting like rewind a year ago in health system industry. And yes, there was conversations about this. We were talking a lot about it on our podcast and internally and with our clients. But in terms of the industry and the market, these conversations were sort of beginning. AI was a huge topic at conferences last year. But this year, there are real case studies. Yeah. There are real proof points. There's real like, here's my receipts. And I think that was so cool about this week. And I actually felt very excited about the hospital and health system world because so many times we say, oh, we're so behind. Oh, we're so behind. We're not retail. And for the first time in a long time, I'm actually like, we're not behind.
Yes.
We're right on
track. Yes, we're not behind.
We're right on track. Now, to your point, are there folks that have not gotten started and do they need to get started today, yesterday? Yes, 100%. But for the most part, you have folks like, you know, like Lisa Mason from Providence and like, you know, Christine Kotler from Baptist Health and folks that have, and
Pam
Amanda
from
Cleveland Clinic. Yeah, that have been pedal to the metal. So why don't we dig into some of the things that they shared?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, so I'll start with the first session that we'll cover, and that is Inside the Real World AI Playbooks of Leading Health Systems. So this was really about receipts. It was about, you know, what have you actually done? So we had Amanda Todorovich from Cleveland Clinic. We had Val Lopez from Baptist Health. And we had Lisa Mason from Providence. And I'll just kind of give a very quick highlight of what each of them talked about and then want to hear your thoughts, Victoria. So I thought what was amazing about what Amanda shared from Cleveland Clinic, no surprises, you know, Cleveland Clinic has been out in front on this for many years. And the reason why I think they're so, their muscles so strong is because their content runs deep and their content has driven their, not just their marketing business, but their business for over a decade. Paul Mattson, you know, as CMO, really put an emphasis on content and even monetized content with advertising. And so as soon as AI came of age, the team very quickly jumped in. Amanda talked about how they've got 50 GPTs, custom GPTs that they built for content creation, but more importantly, how it actually helps the content be higher quality. And my favorite thing she talked about was a specific use case around empathy, an empathy bot that helps humans understand patients and how they might be feeling at a specific given in time, which flips the idea of AI on its head.
So that was robotic. A great example. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Val shared his screen and shared some prototypes that his team, who has, you know, some team members that have no development experience, actually built with AI. And then Lisa from Providence had been leading out on AI applications outside of marketing. So think operations or even clinical or patient facing. And so she had some really great learnings around risks and what to do and not do. So I'll pause there. Anything you would build on from that or any ahas you had, Victoria?
What's interesting is when we think about our Joe Public, our predictors, the one from Cleveland Clinic was very much giving Copernicum Consumer, just like a 2.0, 3.0 version. I immediately thought about that when I heard it. And when you think about consumers having AI agents for health decisions, again, I love the fact that it was being embraced, right? It wasn't being viewed as, again, like adversarial, like sometimes I think is what's happening within Copernicum consumers. What's great is if the agent is there and it's being built by the health system, then they have the power to not only like inform what the patient is receiving in a much more comprehensive way, but it's doing a great job of building trust and with this new age of technology. So again, if we're at the forefront of this and not behind, I think there's huge kudos to be passed across the industry for these really big investments and programs that they're making.
Yeah, I was obsessed with that point. So Amanda really brought up this idea that consumers are leveraging AI as their assistants outside of health and healthcare and inside of health and healthcare. So think shopping assistants. And then she talked about, you know, think about how they're leveraging AI for health purposes. I am with you, Victoria. I think that's such a huge opportunity for how we how do we become the Netflix of healthcare is that. That is how you build a platform. That is a platform. What do you create that gives people a chance to actually use your services as a health partner, not just when they're sick or when they need one thing? This is a way. So I was really excited about that.
And I think there are enough people, enough marketers and communicators who are excited and are probably utilizing generative AI and the other parts of their life, that this is an opportunity for them to bring that passion into their work and help make that patient experience better. And I think sometimes there's a disconnect between how do I bridge that gap? If you're working at a health system, you are a sample of one, yes, but you can obviously see, you know, how these bots and these programs are being used through other brands. And so how can you bring that same experience that you love at insert brand here to shop, to buy your groceries, whatever it may be, and bring it to individuals who are in their most vulnerable state, which is like one of my big soapboxes. When people can't even think straight to tell a doctor with their own mouth, you know, how they're feeling, how much more with the AI agent be there as a empathetic support, as a informative support. I just think there's so much opportunity here. And a year from now, maybe we'll see a lot more advancements in this area.
Yes. So let's go to session two. We'll cover maybe two more sessions in the time we have remaining. You attended a live Victoria AI and content, and I know you listened
in.
So I'm excited to hear your takeaways. The panelists on that session were Carolina Anthony from Advent Health, Ali Karras from MJH Life Sciences, Matt Sear from Loop, and then our own Emily Baker from BPD. So what were your takeaways about content and generative AI?
I love me some content, and I was interested to see how different systems were using it to make their lives better, their work easier, to make workflows a lot more efficient. And Carolina said something so profound, which she said, for years, over a decade, maybe two decades at this point, we have said that content is king or queen. Content is king. And she said, I'm going to switch it up and say context is king within the context of AI. And I was like, mine was blown. And what's interesting, she had this example. She said, as a marketer, we rely on the power of our messages, our words. But what is sometimes happening with AI when they're pulling it and trying to, you know, extrapolate all the information to then give it out to someone that's searching for it, is they're sometimes losing the nuance of what the messaging is trying to say. For example, you could say the butterfly is blue. That is not how these brilliant copywriters are talking about it. They're saying the beautiful butterfly is the color of dawn. Will an AI agent be able to understand what that means metaphorically? Or are they going to say something that is probably going to be lost in the sauce? And so I think what's interesting is we're going to see a lot more advancements around. Yes, we have these agents, these tools to help us to increase the efficiencies in our workflow. But the human is still needed to make sure that everything that's being pulled and created makes sense within the context of what you're talking about. And I still believe that the writers that we have, the content creators, if you will, at these systems, still have jobs to bring that patient experience to life. They're the ones seeing it with their own eyes and experiencing it either by witnessing it with someone else or witnessing it themselves. And that's something that the agents just can't do, which I think is powerful and should give people a little bit of assurance that they're not being replaced by the robots, you know, tomorrow. On the flip side, someone did say that a year from now that it will, people that are not using AI for their work will be have troubles versus those who are using it. So I think that was important to note. Like if we think about an AI assisted human, those people will go further in their work than people who are not using it. Is that a 2020, well, the year's done, a 2026 problem? Maybe not. That could be a 2027 situation, but it's worth noting to our friends who are writers and in content and are building all these powerful words that it's never a bad thing to have a little bit of a minion, if you will, in your corner helping you. And then the final thing she said was around how consumers engage with it. And Stephanie, have you heard this stat before? Which was kind of interesting to me. It shocked me a little bit.
What's that?
So she said 52% of consumers say that they will become less engaged if they clearly see a brand has AI generated content, which there are, there are signs, right? The M-dash, God help us. I love an M-dash, but now if you use it, it's like, oh my gosh, she, you know, pulled it from chat or whatever. But on the flip side, they're saying that the agents are a lot more empathetic than humans who are writing it. So I think there's an interesting like dichotomy between people knowing that it's from an agent or from ChatGPT or wherever it may be, and then still thinking that it's better than what a human may write and more empathetic and compassionate and considerate. So Stephanie, do you think knowing this, how could hospitals and health systems navigate kind of like this living in two worlds, if you will, where people are trying to decipher between what's AI and what's real?
I think it just goes back to making sure that it's used intentionally. And that was a really big theme of the whole week is, first of all, every single panelist or speaker, you know, really highlighted, like, the more that we learn, the more that we are using this tech, the more that we realize this is not a replacement for humans. Like the human actually has the most critical job, which to your point, context is part of the human's job. I like to think about being a context strategist in a way, which is, you know, maybe AI can string words together, but AI doesn't know what happened yesterday with your employee base. AI doesn't know what happened in the, it does know what happened in the world through news headlines, but it doesn't quite know exactly how people felt and it wasn't there and experienced certain things. So the human's job is to ensure that things stay human. But I think the other point is it's not a push button for output. And everybody talked about that, which is These things are here to make us smarter and more strategic. They are not here to just automate the work entirely. Now, there are some work that's great to be automated.
Yeah.
But I think that the cognitive dissonance you're talking about where, you know, if someone knows it's AI generated, they're less likely to be interested. It doesn't matter if it was used correctly, if it was used for research, if it was used to make you smarter, if it was used to help you brainstorm, to help you be critical thinking, to help you push back. You're not like, that's not what we're talking about here. And we actually often always recommend that, you know, hospitals and health systems and healthier organizations are not using AI as a push button for output. It is not a fully generated video, audio, like, and if you use it in the right way, then you don't have to worry about that. So anyway, we could go on and on about this, I think. I want to make sure we just very quickly touch on your session, Victoria, because you're here.
I am, yes.
To kind of tell us in real life, if there was one takeaway or one interesting thing you thought that happened in the enterprise design session, which was all about how do you rethink your org approach, your team approach, your enterprise approach, what was the takeaway?
It's interesting. As we were talking, we had this epiphany that there is a maturity life cycle from taking what, you know, a pilot version of an AI program or AI vision and then taking it enterprise level. And that everyone across the board, which I mentioned a few moments ago, falls within somewhere on the spectrum. And I think it's really easy to say, like, we see Kaiser and so many people that are creating chief AI officers. And then if you're starting at the beginning, you again may feel behind. What's fascinating is that they were basically saying, or we were saying, that we're not behind, that systems have the opportunity to actually start from square one in 2026. And I think what was interesting is that we had like just some easy ways to get started. One, like respectfully, like mandate, engage in the consumer facing version of the platform. In some cases, people are like anti completely of using it at all. And I think those people may get left behind, which is what, you know, kind of what we talked about. But having people do AI trainings, just to kind of get an understanding of how the platforms can be used, how the agents can be used. That's for someone that's going to be kind of, you know, starting their journey. If someone's further along, maybe they can learn about development or creating an AI vision, or, you know, having some small wins to solve problems in the organization. And then when we think about someone further along the life cycle, creating that vision, we encourage marketing leaders that they could be at the forefront of creating that vision. We told them that you don't have to wait or give the task to someone in IT or digital, wherever it may be, that that vision can come from marketing. And marketing can serve as like a facilitator of all these brilliant departments who are doing things already that are going to be impacted by AI in the future. And so it was more so of like a rallying conversation and mission to say, like, you are empowered. You have the opportunity to really be positioned as a strategic thought leader in your organization when it comes to creating that AI vision, and to not go away from it because of fear of the unknown, especially when there are so many resources and trainings out there.
Yeah. Well, maybe we end on that point, because I think that's a great like next step of what you do and how do you actually implement. So thank you. Thank you for joining, Victoria. This is always a fun convo with you. And I think you and I could listen to you all day. Well, for anybody listening, thank you as always for joining us. Make sure you share the show with somebody who maybe asked about AI recently or is interested in it or wants to know how they can get started, or maybe someone who is, you know, a year into their journey. As always, don't be satisfied with the normal. Push the no normal. Push into the nuances of context and humans' jobs and, you know, the future. So with that, we will talk to you soon.
Three, two, one. Here we go.